Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2018. And it is my great delight to welcome back to Millennial this year the delectably Indo-European Survive the Jive. Welcome to Millennial.
Thanks for that intro, Woz. It's good to be back as always. Always a great time of year, Millennial, and appreciate that you you could do a lot of interviews this time of year, so it must be a big strain, but it's worth it because everyone comes together and has a cozy time and spreads the festive joy. So good Yule to you and all your subscribers, and Wassail.
All right. Well, okay, the first question, well, the first thing to say is what a nice woolly jumper it is that you're wearing. So would you like to explain why it is so lovely and woolly?
This is a Cornish fisherman's jumper. I don't actually live in Cornwall, but I'm nearby. I'm in that part of the world. And it is knitted for fishermen because they like it for the same reason Norwegians like woolen knits, because it doesn't soak up the water so much as cotton. So you can be out by the sea and get a bit wet and you get hypothermia, basically. So it's a chilly, windy, rainy part of the world where I live in. And that same as it was in Scandinavia, but so yeah, you've got to have a knit. And anyway, it's Christmas, so you've got to wear a knit at Christmas, right?
Well, of course, of course. Yeah. And I have ventured down there on only one occasion, and yes, it was quite harsh because, of course, you're close to the sea, so I mean, it's cold.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as cold as it's actually quite warm in general because the temperature doesn't go down that low, but it feels cold because it's damper than the rest of Britain. It gets more rain than anywhere else in Britain, except the western part of Ireland. But yeah, it's very wet and windy. There's high winds coming in off the sea as well. So
yeah, of course, of course,
makes it feel cold, even though actually technically the temperature isn't that bad.
Right. Well, the other question I wanted to ask you, because from the text chat before we get started, is this is someone else's wording. I didn't say this. Someone else said, "Ask him how he keeps such an amazing beard." So do you have any tips?
Okay. Well, I don't know. Basically, don't wash it too much, but trim it as well, and keep it trimmed. And it depends what kind of your genetics, really. If you've got oily hair, then don't put any oil in it. Like, just try not to, try to maybe do wash it more. And if you've got naturally dry, then try not to wash it too much and put some oil in it occasionally. Just it depends on the person, really, and on what you're doing. But yeah, I think trim beards look better, more neat and tidy. So I trim my cut it this way.
And how often do you do that?
I don't know. I don't have like a day. I do it just trim. When I look in the mirror and there's scissors nearby and I think I need a trim. I should normally. I think, I'm going to go on Millennial. I'll give it a trim. I didn't give it a trim today because I've been busy with things. I went to go and do deadlifts at the gym instead. So,
oh, all right. Cheers.
Sorry, mate.
it's all right. Okay. All right. Well, yes. Okay. I think that's probably enough on the beard question.
Did I say who I am for those of your?
Right. I didn't even introduce. I just said that, yeah, okay. So you go ahead and introduce yourself to anyone who's somehow ignorant of who you are.
Yeah, my name's Survive the Jive. It's my YouTube channel, aka Tom Rousell. I'm a historian focused on Anglo-Saxons. I made a film in 2013 about Anglo-Saxons putting people in touch. I wanted English people to get in touch with their roots and know about their identity and how that ties back to Anglo-Saxons. And from there, after that film, my channel started to get a bit bigger, my YouTube channel called Survive the Jive, partly because of the help of Millennial Woz, who put me on Millennial in 2015, but also other people like the Golden One have helped to grow it. And now it started to gather a bit more steam, but I think it started to slow down now, perhaps because of shadow ban or something, because
it's God only knows. Who knows the tricks they're pulling to thwart our channel's growth? I mean, seriously, yeah. I mean, they're not sending out notifications for these live streams. Let's not go into that. I mean, there's been a lot of people in Millennial this year moaning about the censorship and so on, and very justifiably so. But you and I have a more sort of, not happiness, novel and nourishing topic that we're going to go into. So yes. But the first thing to say is that this is this should function as a sort of promo for Survive the Jive's new book. And you know, I'm not in any way...
He's not being paid to say this.
But I have no moral qualms about doing this, because it's absolutely right that we, you know, that we help each other out like this and advertise, because after all, it is your own work. So please tell people about the book.
Basically, this is the latest thing I've done. I got contacted by an artist in Canada, a comic book artist, very talented guy called Christopher Steininger. His company is Smile Titans, and he wanted to work with me. He's been working with Lindy Beige, the YouTuber, on a different comic, and while that was being developed, he said he wanted to work on something else with me, and I suggested, because I love the genre of folk horror, which we'll get into, I wanted to do a Christmas ghost story for all ages, and we made it as an animation for his channel. It's on YouTube. You can see the whole thing for free. But then some people in the comments said last Christmas, this should be a book. So Christopher got to work getting it as a book, and we self-published it, mainly due to his efforts. But now it's ready to buy from smiletitans.com. And this is my first book. I intended to do something more, you know, like a scholarly about paganism as my first, but this is all about paganism, and it teaches, even kids can understand it. And it's got these really beautiful pictures of this Victorian guy who goes back in time, like a spirit of Christmas called the Green Knight, who's actually from Arthurian literature, but he serves the same role as the Christmas spirit in Dickens, A Christmas Carol. So it's kind of like a parody of the Christmas Carol, but instead of seeing all the bad things he's done or whatever, he goes back and sees how pagans used to celebrate Christmas in Anglo-Saxon times. So yeah, it's really great, especially if you want to get your kids or your nephew or niece a little bit more conscious of the roots of their, you know, of their people, and also to learn about paganism in general. It's not just for pagans. It's historically accurate. And I've put in the front an introduction where I explain all the sources and how I've come up with everything. So yeah, it's completely no political correctness in this book. It's just a good, fun Christmas book, a ghost story for all ages. And I hope everyone loves it.
That sounds great. And I have to say, from what I could see there, the illustrations do look very nice, very pleasant.
Yeah, I think they're quite cozy. He's done an interesting style. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. So, okay, we're going to get to the main topic now, which is a genre of folk horror. Now, so you're saying that book comes under that genre. Are you sure about that, or you want to go into that?
Well, I wrote it intentionally to try to be folk horror because I love the genre. But to let people know, like, folk horror is centered around the film from the 70s called The Wicker Man, but no one called it folk horror at the time, and the genre didn't exist really until I think it was 2010, when one of this a comedian from a British series called The League of Gentlemen, a guy called Mark Gatiss, he did a TV series on BBC4 about the history of the horror genre. And he devoted an entire section of that to something he termed folk horror. And that, like, it gave a name to something a lot of people loved but didn't know had a name. And it was like a subsection of the horror. And it included things like The Blood on Satan's Claw, The Wicker Man, and a load of other things, including things that aren't so much horror, but like television series like Children of the Stones. And it's not something that I know you'd like, Bose, because we've spoken about it before, is the old BBC Ghost Story for Christmas series, which was very much folk horror as well. And basically, folk horror is like part of the horror genre where it can be supernatural or sometimes it isn't, but always it's based on the English soil, like the English land and the history of it is somehow the source of horror. So Children of the Stones is like the stone circles at Avebury, and The Wicker Man, you've got this kind of rural, isolated community practicing paganism. So, and Blood on Satan's Claw is like about witchcraft. The Witchfinder General is about witchcraft. And since that documentary came out, like other films have come out, like A Field in England and The Witch, a New England folktale, which are different, but they definitely subconsciously sort of try to market these films into that genre that had now found a name for itself. And that's also what I tried to do with mine. It's not horror, as in it's not really trying to scare people. It's meant to be for all ages, but a lot of the folk horror genre is often children's programs from the 70s from England as well. So that's not all like that. But
there was a time when I was far more I had a lot more of these things stored up in my memory than I do now, because it's been quite a few years. And honestly, you know, working on the channel takes up so much of my time that I haven't watched the. I mean, I don't watch TV series or, you know, films or anything, you know, very often at all. So my memory of these things has really faded. But you know, like 5 years ago, I could probably have named you like quite a few TV series that would fall into this category, just, you know, based on what you're saying. But one of them obviously would be Children of the Stones.
Yeah.
I mean, there are others as well, but I, you know, they elude me now.
The Owl Service.
Oh, The Owl Service. Well, of course. That yeah. was 69 or 68. That is a very strange, I mean, we can go into this later, but it's a very strange production. And I think there are, I mean, Alan Garner, I think probably everything that I know of that he's done would probably fall into this category. But why don't you spend a bit more time sort of defining the category for people? Because you and I have seen quite a few of these things, these examples of it, but other people won't have, so they won't know what we're talking about.
Well, I'll do that, and I'll also try and explain why I like it and why maybe, like, because this is a right-wing hangout, so why do I think it's even relevant to right-wing people? And Countercurrents, a Finnish guy, did an article on Countercurrents about folk horror called Folk and Horror. And you can read that from if you want that. But there's also some a lot of folk horror fans are left wing, and The Guardian has done some stuff on it. And a lot of people are trying to understand why is it that everyone likes folk horror, because and everyone left wing people have left wing theories, right?
You know,
people have
right-wing theories, it's funny because sorry to interrupt, but I suspect this is going to go in the same direction as you know, what you end up with is left wingers who like something right wing, but they can't afford to work out why they like it, because if they did, it would call into question their. And another example of it is all these bloody leftists who love Harry Potter, when it's you know, it's snobbery, elitism, traditionalism, and so on. I mean, obviously, it's wrapped in a saccharine, champagne, socialist, modern glaze, but still, the core of it is this, well, hierarchical English traditional boarding school. And all the conventions and traditions that are in this school and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, but they can't afford to admit that they like the elitism of it, the fuddy-fuddiness of it, and so on.
Well, on at least some level, I definitely agree with you, because in the sense, at least in the sense that most horror, folk horror films and television programs are entirely like homogenous, just English white people in them. And in that sense, by just seeking out these, text, these media texts, they might be subconsciously, you know, avoiding some things that they have to actually experience on a day-to-day life in their cities. But I do think that they have a point, because the left-wing explanation for why they like it, and I actually think they might be right. They say, I can quote here from The Guardian's article on it, I can't remember the name of the author, but he says, the films feature a recurring archetype, the arrival of a stranger, the discovery of a secret cult, then a vicious murder, designed perhaps to propitiate pagan gods. The metropolitan visitor, the outsider from the mainland, comes into a situation strange to them and to us. Here, the enlightened laws of the nation do not pertain. In these forgotten spaces, there are other laws, rules, and rituals that are both familiar remnants of some tribal memory, yet utterly strange. The locals understand, while we do not. Their rootedness in place becomes uncanny. Once almost everyone was so rooted, but now in the discontinuous world of modernity where relationships are casual and work comes and goes, such belonging feels strange and even sinister. So I think that that's a truthful sort of left-wing psychological perspective on it. They're afraid of rooted communities and what they represent, perhaps, or maybe the repression of their desire to be rooted is then is coming back to them in a fearful way. Or in an obsessive way that manifests in horror. That isn't my view of folk horror at all, but I think that they're telling the truth there.
Yeah. And I think that another part of it is to get on to just to go back to the ethnic aspect of it. I often wonder, there are lots of lefties who are fans of you know, TV, British TV and film from the 60s and 70s. And I often wonder... Well, indeed. And I often wonder, how do these people feel about the fact that they'll, you know, they'll be watching some old thing and they love it and all this, but everyone in it is white. And does that make them feel guilty for liking it? Do they feel a sort of disgust with themselves?
I think they're constantly feeling guilty.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. Even their enjoyment of this thing is sullied by the fact that, you know, it's all white. I mean, I guess at some level they'll tell themselves, it would be even better if there were black actors and, you know, Pakistani actors in this. I really wish it weren't all white. I mean, it's the flagellation that must go on in the mind of a champagne socialist. But anyway, to leave that aside, because that's a bit too... I feel that there's more sort of interesting stuff to be talked about here. About their rootedness. Because you're it's very clear that left-wing thought seems to thrive in the cities. I mean, that's a very broad statement, but it has all sorts of implications. And, one of them is you get this Gentile... cosmopolitan lefty for whom, you know, the rural world, and especially the remote rural world, like Summer Isle and all this, is baffling and frightening, because it doesn't care about their concerns. It's not sympathetic to their life in the city.
Yeah, and I think that must be part of that must be part of the way that even the creators read that these films. Like The Wicker Man was this directed by a Christian urban guy and written by a Jewish urban guy. And they're collaborating on that with a perspective. And they were thinking on, it's like, what about a rural community in a terms of as other, right? They're always the other, and the urban is the sophisticated and cultured and culturally superior within the text. So that shows, of course, the bias of the people involved in it. And that presumes that that's what the audience perspective will be as well. But of course, I mean, from when I see it, like The Wicker Man, for me, my grandfather's farm was just near Kirkcudbright, and that's where it was filmed. So I knew like a lot of the places, like the graveyard, the harbour at the beginning. And I didn't see it as like the other place. I see it as that was like a normal place. And this Sergeant Howie, this Christian guy screaming his head off, he was the other to me.
Well, that's how I always took it. I mean, I have to say, the first time I saw The Wicker Man, I thought it was hilarious, actually. I didn't really, I thought it was a badly written thing. And badly acted, quite frankly, and I still don't really like it. I mean, I still think I think it's quite clumsily done. But it's one of those things I've never got around to talking about on the channel. There are some bits that are just so funny and hilarious.
Which bit? What are you talking about? Britt Eklund bum dance.
Britt Eklund saying some things in their natural state have the most vivid colours. You know, all this kind
doing
of stuff.
A sweet, doing a Scottish accent.
Yeah, and even just the way he goes, when he goes, she asks him what he wants after dinner, and he says, apple. and she goes, no apples. And he says, no apples, on Summer Isle. It's like, here's the plot device. Now we'll explain and move things forward.
No, but I think he did that deliberately because he saw the orchards, right? Because when he's coming in, he's seen the orchards.
Because the island is famous for its apples. So right, that was established.
So he wanted to taste the apples that were... Yeah. And the fruit was crucial to the plot as well, because that was the reason for the sacrifice, the failing of the fruit trees. And that's why she said no apples.
I know, but that's what I mean. And I know that it's the whole thing is plot. But I just don't think
someone would say apple for apples.
He didn't even say an apple, please, or something. He just said apple, that kind of thing. But it's just the sort of obviousness of it feels more like a comedy sketch than a well-written drama to me. It's sort of clumsy.
Yeah.
But I don't want
I think it influenced comedy, like, because The League of Gentlemen is very like folk horror kind of thing. It's a British comedy for people aren't aware. About a small town named Royston Vasey after a racist British comedian whose entire routine was insulting ethnic minorities, basically. But they named it after him. And anyway, Countercurrents have also done an article on The League of Gentlemen recently as well, for people who are interested in that.
I'm surprised. That's another lefty. Yeah, but let's not get into that. Somebody, by the way, just mentioned Robin Redbreast in the live chat, which is
Oh, that's great, yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't seen that. But it does seem to have been a sort of proto... Well, actually, I think it predates The Wicker Man, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was like a year before.
I'm not sure, yeah, but it's interesting from the right. I wanted to do a talk with on Frodi Midjord's podcast about that. We might do it. We're going to do one on something anyway. But that one's very interesting because it also includes sort of not only paganism like the Wicker Man, but it's got a kind of Third Reich element in, because the male in it is obsessed with the SS and the warrior initiatory warrior cults.
Oh, I didn't know this. I had no idea about this.
This is main passion is knowing everything there is to know about the SS, and it's kind of integrated into the paganism. So, yeah, I mean, obviously these texts, I mean, these films, they're all written by left-wing people, not trying to misguide people into saying anything, you know, mislead people. But nevertheless, there are things to be enjoyed about them. Like, they still, they're enjoyable because they're not politically correct. They're not interested in being politically correct. And they concern rural communities and, you know, even though they're kind of, in a way, demonizing rural communities, there's some cathartic element to like seeing the outsider come in feeling superior and then punished for it by the community.
Yeah. And now before we get into that, I want to say, even though I do find the Wicker Man sort of clumsy in some ways and funny in some ways, I don't want to disparage it, because it's obvious that it is a very special film to a lot of people, including you. Yeah, and you know, I always think it's a bummer when someone else says, well, actually, you shouldn't like this thing, and here are 10 reasons why this thing that excites you actually shouldn't. And it's not like you're going to be grateful for hearing those, you know, your thing dissected like that. So it's a sort of, it's annoying. And I'm not going to do that because, you know, it's obviously, I don't know, maybe if I saw it now for the first time, I would take it more seriously. As it is, I was a sort of sarcastic art student at the time, and, you know, it was easy to disparage it.
But I actually did when I was a student, I did my dissertation on that, on The Wicker Man and other films. So I was, even though I was a bit of a, like you, I was a bit of a arty-farty wanker, to be honest, but, writing for trendy art magazines and things like that. But I still just love this stuff. But I was actually, my dissertation got a very bad mark because, I hadn't realized then, but I was, in 2007, I was doing it. I wrote it on representation of rural communities in horror films from the 70s. And I used it on, like, they gave us all this feminist and black theory about, like, oppressions and like, misrepresentation of, like, black people or whatever people in film. And I was just saying, well, think about, wait, hasn't anyone done this on, like, rural working class people? Because they're always demonized. And I completely wasn't thinking, like, oh, I'm doing something subversive and right-wing. I was just thinking that this was, like, a normal thing. And they didn't like it at all. They didn't, like,
You broke the rules without meaning to, sort of.
Yeah, I didn't know that you weren't supposed to defend these people or, like, point out the hypocrisy. And that was probably a big wake-up call, because it my degree was, I still passed my degree, but my dissertation was a much lower mark than I think it could have got. But for my media degree, that is. So, yeah. It's quite obvious to anyone who watches, like, not just folk horror, but other things like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or The Hills Have Eyes, whatever. You can have, or Straw Dogs. You always have the same format that was mentioned before.
Or Deliverance.
Deliverance,
that.
Yeah. That's a good example as well. It's like getting, like, is it really the typical of, like, rural hunters that they just bum rape some dude that they find in the woods? I don't think that is what they do. I mean, I'm not familiar with American culture that much, but I just don't think that's what people in the countryside do. I mean, very much like to get raped or murdered. It's not in the woods or the countryside or in some, like, you know, high trust rural community. It's complete opposite. So,
well, yeah, of course. But of course, in the case of Hollywood. Is it safe to go into this, do you think? I'm not sure if it's safe to go into
this.
I
think it's implicit anyway, so you don't need to say anything more.
All right. Yeah, there are reasons why Hollywood would make films demonizing rural whites. Let's put it that way. Hmm. Actually, there was something else that came up about this just the other day. What was it? It's not going to come. But just the other day, something else reminded me of this. There was another story, something similar to that. But I've forgotten already. So I think with the Wicker Man and the go more into that, because see, it's interesting from your perspective. You know the places, or at least some of them.
Yeah,
but I think that perhaps blinds you to the way that a lot of people will see it, which is they will see it as alien. I mean, even I grew up in Scotland, and not urban Scotland, like rural Scotland. But even to me, that's a bloody strange place. That summer.
Okay, at. Of course, I can't say that I was used to seeing naked women skipping around Stone Circle, unfortunately. But I mean, I'm just talking about the places, you know, like the place itself, like, I mean, it's more than that, though. I feel like, well, I was raised Christian, Catholic, anyway. That's a particular area, the very Protestant area, because it's the part of the coast that faces out to Belfast. It's where you get the ferry to Belfast. So it's complete opposite to the religion that I was raised in, of Catholicism. But I always kind of felt like very pagan anyway, personally, in my, like, I think when I was a child, I was probably like on some level a pagan, because my natural tendencies for religion were like, just, I didn't really believe in anything in the Bible. I believed in God, but I didn't think it was what the priests tell me it was. And I also thought like that there was an imminent sense of divinity in other places that I could feel, that I didn't know if it was the same thing or what, but I just intuitively knew that. Intuitively felt that to be the case. So anyway, maybe that's influenced my view of the Wicker Man, but it does also seem like maybe it's something more simple and less spiritual, and just basically the fact that it depicts like a quite, it's got a nice score, it's got some nice English countryside scenes. The conflict in it is, I mean, there
just to be precise, and I'm not being a dick.
Scottish Dumfriesshire, yeah. Used to be English a long time ago, but it was one of the parts of Anglo-Saxon England. Yeah, I was a slip of the tongue, Freudian slip, or if you want to say that. But the Scottish countryside, but in other folk horror, it's English countryside. So,
yeah, I mean, actually, the Wicker Man is basically the only example of this in Scotland, isn't it? I can't think of anything else.
Wasn't there? Was Hitchhikers, as it was called, or something like that? Or I don't remember. No, Kill List. Was that in Scotland partly?
I don't know that one. I haven't heard of that one.
That's a modern one. That was quite good. But anyway, yeah. It's the point isn't whether it's English or Scotland. The point is that you've got, like, it's cozy and comfortable to watch, like, nice countryside, homogenous society. There is a dilemma. There's a problem in the films. There's a murder or something. But, yeah, it's like, actually, even the horror of these folk horrors is quite considerably less horrific than the things that are actually happening in the real world to us now.
Oh, absolutely. But one other aspect that we should definitely bring into this is that, and I don't know if you must have be aware of this, that the format of these stories, these dramas and films, is kind of taken from M.R. James, in that you've got an educated... not metropolitan necessarily, but an educated, you know, person of civilization who goes to a much less civilized place and or much less urban place, let's say, and, you know, comes up against things that he cannot cope with for whatever reason.
That obviously appeals to me as well. Being I'm someone who believes in gods, in divinity, so. I think that materialism is a problem. I know that not everyone on the right agrees with that, but I think it is. And obviously something like M.R. James, where you have this, like, in Whistle and I'll Come to You, you've got this very, like, very autistically logical Englishman who won't like, say, believe in any superstition or anything. His views are challenged by being confronted by something supernatural. It's very simple, but it's a very effective form of, you know, horror and entertainment in general. And I love the original dramatization of that as well.
The omnibus. Well, actually, I should say, may as well just say now that Survive the Jive and I made a decision that next year for Millennial, we're going to do something a wee bit different, and we're going to pre-record it and talk about the series A Ghost Story for Christmas. Yeah. And we're going to publish it on Christmas Day. So that'll be something nice to look forward to, hopefully. But obviously it was too late this year to do it, because we only had the idea, this morning. So we couldn't do it. But there we are. That's what we're going to do for Millennial next year. But this year, we're going to... A Ghost Story for Christmas.
We should recommend people to watch those this year. Yes. When you have a spare moment between your mince pies and sherry or whatever, go on YouTube and look up Ghost Story for Christmas and watch them.
They're so good. I mean, beautifully made productions from, I think the first one was 68 or 69, and the rest were from the early, like, first half of the 70s. No, actually, throughout the 70s. And my favorite one is The Signalman,
in my mind as well, that one.
Really, really good. But that's the only one that's not based on an M.R. James story. But it's Charles Dickens, but I think all of the others are M.R. James. But let's not get into that, because that's really, we should leave that for next year. Just say that it's a really charming, well-made British TV thing. It's kind of like a series. There was one episode every Christmas. And just really delightful, really delightful stuff. And please go and watch that so that you're primed for next year's Millennial with Survive the Giant. But for this one, I mean, we could have brought that into this one, but it seemed a bit of a, it should be its own thing because it deserves to be. It's really special. So obviously, how did we get into this?
We were talking about M.R. James, so
that is the sort of general trope that was used in the folk horror genre, and obviously
also in other horror as well. It's hard to define, because I said it was originally used by that guy Gatiss to describe specifically horror films from Britain from the 70s. But subsequently, a following of people, fans around it, have started to try and expand it. And, like, I don't know whether they would include Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because it has a lot of the tropes, right? It's countryside, something horrible. I mean, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre doesn't feel like a folk horror film. There's something about folk horror, to me, I think of as
British.
Feels like a British thing. And, I mean, like, if in America, there are American Werewolf, I guess you could say American Werewolf in London was folk horror because it's set in Britain. About a Jewish guy who gets turned into a werewolf on the Yorkshire Dales. And that's a very interesting point to make out that he's Jewish, because although the actor is Italian, the director specifically wanted the character to be Jewish, the guy coming to England. And he only cast that Italian guy because he thought he was Jewish. And there was meant to be a full frontal nudity scene for the transformation into the werewolf. And the director, seeing that the actor wasn't circumcised, was horrified. And then cut the scene. So he didn't intend to cast a Gentile. But
I'm surprised they couldn't manage a prosthetic. I mean, given how realistic and convincing the rest of that transformation scene.
The transformation was great, but it wouldn't go that far. Maybe it's too sacred.
There was something else. Oh yes, in the live chat, somebody mentioned the Stone Tape, and now the Stone Tape, is it's more hauntology than folk horror, I would say.
I don't know that one, the Stone Tape.
Oh my god, it's fantastic. It's a really nice what's his name who wrote Quatermass? Nigel Neal.
Quatermass in the Pit is folk horror, I think.
I haven't seen any of the Quatermass series. So I don't really know. But he also did a series called Beasts in 1976, which is kind of similar. But The Stone Tape is really nice. It's scientists who set up in this mansion house, this old ancient mansion, and they don't realize that there's one particular room that records events that happen in the room. And I think I can't remember exactly how it all plays out, but it's got some amusing early 70s stuff in it like the computer that can answer any question, that kind of stuff. But it is beautifully done, and it's fun, and the ending is very scary as well.
Oh, I'll make sure to watch that.
Definitely. You can get it on, I was going to say DVD, but I've remembered that it's 2018. I'm sure you can download it somewhere.
Only legally, of course. Wouldn't advocate for any illegal downloading.
Of course. And that goes without saying. No, I actually wasn't talking about pirating. I was just saying that there's probably, you can get it on, I don't know, Amazon downloaded service or whatever.
It's hard. You can't see this stuff on Netflix, unfortunately.
That's the thing. It is quite obscure.
It doesn't meet the diversity quotas. It doesn't have the correct portrayal of women or whatever.
No, indeed. But that was a point in the essay on countercurrents that you linked me to, which I was scanning before we started this. So you've got this sort of conservative fuddy-duddy Sergeant Howie who arrives on Summer Isle in The Wicker Man. But the community of Summer Isle is also conservative in its own way. It's not a lefty egalitarian
But it does have some. It does have some lefty. I mean, they projected a sexual morality of the 1960s, like hippie culture, onto that. And I think the director said, like, they know that this probably isn't a form of paganism that ever existed.
But at the same time, in the article, it pointed out that it's not about sex as pleasure; it's sex for procreation.
Yeah, and so, sex as ritual, which is actually that is traditional. But I mean, obviously, the way it's done in the film doesn't represent any traditional form of paganism that existed. It's still interesting because it makes for the film makes a greater contrast between this conservative Protestant policeman who represents British society and then the pagans from outside. But of course, if a policeman was sent from modern Britain to Summer's Isle, it would be quite a different story.
Oh, yeah, they'd all have Pornhub and Netflix and all the rest of it.
I was just saying that his reaction would be different. He wouldn't care about the skipping around naked, but he would be outraged by the lack of diversity.
Well, at least they could all agree on Netflix and Pornhub. He'd have that in common with them. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, that's just nihilistic. But the point is that nowadays, it's really quite inconceivable that a remote community would be that cut off and different from the mainstream, because communications, transport, everything, it's just
well, it was privately owned, right? So maybe Lord Summer's Isle, Christopher Lee, just banned all internet on the island or something. He could do it that way. But that's what the problem with the remake was, a bit with Nicolas Cage, was really a bit absurd. I don't know if you know about that. I think it was 2006.
The bees.
It became a meme for it being so ridiculous. But the idea that there was this island of off the east coast of America that would be that like isolated. But there was also, I think, there were some right wing themes in that, because in that one, the pagans on the island are actually like Wiccans, and it's a feminist society, and there's no Lord Summer's Isle. It's a matriarchy. So Nicolas Cage goes in and just starts beating up women. So it's kind of like the Mukhtar film or something.
Well, I haven't watched it, but it does sound hilarious. Yeah, Nicolas Cage is generally quite reliable if you're wanting a laugh. But there was another aspect to this that, and I haven't seen this. I expect that you have, but maybe you haven't. The sequel to The Wicker Man that the director did, Robin Hardy, made just before he died.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. Wicker Man 2, is it called?
Really?
I didn't know about that.
It's got the actress Honeysuckle Weeks in it, who I've always really fancied, but I haven't seen the film. It's, is it The Wicker Tree? I think it's called
The Wicker Tree. I see this now. Maybe I did see that. It might be, if it was very bad, I'd try and banish it from my memory. That could explain it, but I can't remember it. I'm getting the wrong kind of things coming up when I put Honeysuckle on.
Honeysuckle Week. I'll find. I'm sure it's called The Wicker Tree. It'd be about 2012. Let's see, 2011. Yeah, there it is, The Wicker Tree, and it is a sort of sequel. I believe he either was going to or did film a cameo with Christopher Lee as Lord Summer Isle.
It's got 3.9 on IMDb.
Out of 5 or 10?
Out of 10. Ooh. That's really bad. Because usually fans of the films go and vote on it to say that they like it and give it a slightly higher rating than it deserves. But so I don't remember. Maybe I should check it out anyway. It's set in Scotland again, apparently. But
Yeah. It's. I don't know anything about it, but it was there. And I think he was going to do a trilogy, and he wanted to. There was going to be a third one, but then he died, and there we are. So it's a bit of a shame. Ah, yes, there we are. He had proposed a third film, but he died in 2016.
That's sad.
Mm. There we are. It was I believe also that there was going to be a sequel a long time ago with Sergeant Howie, who had survived the ending of the first film, and he was sort of like, you know, charred and deformed and all this, and he was
Punished Howie coming back.
Yeah. And he was going to take revenge on Lord Samurai somehow. There we are. But it never happened.
Yeah. I don't know what I think about that. It does sound like a cash in, to be honest.
Yeah, and ridiculous. But so are there any other things you'd like to tell people about the folk horror genre?
Well, only that it's I think the right needs to be much more involved, and a lot of people say this. Like, we need to be involved in arts. We need to have musicians, painters, sculptors, filmmakers, all these things. And we need to not just be doing stuff that's derivative, but we need, of course, all art is somewhat derivative, but we need to kind of find formats that work for us. And I think that folk horror is an unexplored genre because it looks at the earth and the community fixed communities on the land as being united and somehow dangerous, which is actually, that's what I think that the people in charge at the moment really think, and that's what they're afraid of. And I think that instead of demonizing these communities, I think that it can be played upon and explored as a genre in comic books or literature or whatever, and from other perspectives, you know, not just the left-wing perspectives. And that's what I have to say, really. And I'm going to do that, and that's what I've done with my book, which I have somewhere around here. Yeah, and I intend to do with other things as well. Maybe I don't know. I'm going to do another comic with Christopher for next year, but it won't be folk horror. It'll be a comparative religion thing be more like an instructive picture book, like not with a narrative. Well, with narratives that are taken from Indo-European mythology. So I'm thinking about doing something about Ithan's golden apples and the Indo-European myths about apples that are come from a common root. And that way it's like, instead of just having a boring textbook explaining a comparative religion and how the Celts, the Greeks, the Romans, the Norse all have a common religious source and a common cultural source in the Proto-Indo-Europeans, in a boring way, but an informative way, which is already done by people like David Anthony and James Mallory anyway. I think we should do it in a new way, in a way that's more digestible to a greater audience and with nice artwork. And that's something that's missing as well. And also, these topics need to be picked up by us before other people pick them up and distort them. Because as everyone's seen for this year from the way the media have handled certain events back in January with Cheddar Man and everything, they will try and take this, you know, findings and use them and manipulate the way they portray what the information they do include and what they don't exclude to create, you know, the version of history that they want people to believe in.
And it's so blatant. I don't want to go into a huge tangent about this, but obviously the Cheddar Man thing was simply outrageous.
Yeah,
and the fact that once it was debunked, it was simply forgotten about because the damage was done. That was the intended effect. Mm. The intended effect had been achieved, and it didn't matter. The truth was totally irrelevant.
Well, we have to have long memories. I think it's Nietzsche who said that history belongs to those with the longest memory or something like that. We need to remember all these things and bring them up when necessary to defame, you know, the people who claim to be authorities or authoritative sources. We can show how many times they lie or they even they don't lie, they manipulate facts or, you know, no one, a lot of, like some very prominent scientists, one who was behind the Cheddar Man thing and one who is a UN approved like geneticist whose books are for sale in the UN in Geneva, they jump onto my little Twitter account to correct me on things that I might have got wrong. I'm not even a geneticist. But when Athel Hirsch says something completely outlandish, like black people were in Britain before English were.
And this is a serious...
They know full well. And she was published by the National Geographic and on the BBC, and she was Channel 4. She was saying the things. They're fucking quiet. They don't say a word. They've got nothing to say then. And they know she's wrong, completely wrong. but they'll keep an eye on like an irrelevant, like comparatively powerless and irrelevant person like me. I don't have any a voice except a tiny Twitter platform. But they're you know, it just shows how hypocritical and dishonest they're being.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, she is a respected journalist.
And it's crazy. It's just a grievance monger, a liar.
This is how bad the situation is. That we have like the people that we're supposed to be able to rely on to tell us about the world today and the world as it was then, and the relationship, how we should think about the world then, and you know, the relationships between the everything. The people who we're supposed to be able to rely on to weave a fabric of understanding are simply bullshitting. They have no fealty to the truth at all. And
it's quite remarkable that they can just come out and say these things. I think they must have in their heads justified it by saying that it's all for a moral good, so that they can say whatever outrageous lies and slanders they like, because they think it's all in the end it's morally correct to do so. Because I can't imagine a self-respecting human being doing something like that otherwise.
Yeah. It's so contrary to, well, journalistic integrity, for one thing. That's that. I mean, and then there was a similar thing more recently as well with, just a few weeks ago, about Africans being in Britain before anyone else.
Yeah, it was Gary Young. It was the guy who...
God, that guy again.
That kind of short little chap.
Yeah. We all know Gary Young. Yeah. I seriously doubt that.
Well, this time he was basing it. I'm trying to remember. I think he was basing it on some outdated, like, ideas about what Gravettians were. So a long time ago, some Gravettian skull was looked at and thought maybe morphologically would be Negroid. And then, Afrocentrists ran with that and said, okay, so the Gravettians were prehistoric stone caveman people in Europe a long, long time ago. And they ran with that and said that they were blacks and that black people lived there. And then, of course, now we have DNA. And we know the Gravettians were not black at all. They didn't have black DNA. But, of course, Young didn't get the memo or whatever. He's carrying on. Like, he just dug up one specific Afrocentrist book I've never heard of, and saying, and in that book it says, that black people
we was Brits,
and he was just doing that. And of course there are people like Young doing this kind of stuff. I'm not surprised that there are stupid people making mistakes, but what I'm surprised at is that this is like mainstream media, that this guy with no qualifications to speak on that subject, has done no research into like what findings are on that subject, just comes out and said that, and they make it like a big title, like black people were there first. Of course they must know that. Maybe it's just to harvest clicks, that they know it's like hate clicks or whatever. But I think it's more than that. It's about, you know, demoralization of the native population.
Oh yeah. As somebody said in the live chat, to destroy a people, you must first sever their roots.
That's a quote from Karl Marx.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know it was from him, actually. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I have to fact check it, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Someone else can do that. I want to, because somebody asked about the out of Africa thing. I mean, we may as well just briefly go into that. We will return to the folk horror thing, but let's just have a wee sojourn into other topics. Did we, as far as you know, with the current research and all that, are we all from Africa?
Well, I was born in Cambridgeshire. So... I'm not from Africa.
Don't be facetious.
But like, okay, are we all from the ocean? Because like, if you go back far enough, we evolved from some microbe, some like single cell organism. Like, I think like a lot of people on the right are too concerned with trying to disprove the out of Africa hypothesis. It shouldn't matter. What is really important to understand is that human evolution, like the differences, the big differences that make for huge variations in populations, don't take millions of years to happen. They don't take thousands of years to happen. Well, they do take thousands, but not many thousands. They can happen over, like, I mean, the Tibetans, a distinct population from the Han Chinese, just 5,000 years ago, and now they have a special genetic adaptation for living at high altitudes. That's really, really important and crucial survival adaptation. It didn't go back to the Ice Age. It doesn't go back to, you know, prehistory. it doesn't matter. Like, if we have African ancestors, that doesn't make any difference. Like, it shouldn't change how you see yourself. What you need to question is not whether we came from Africa, but whether you should change your sense of identity as a result. You shouldn't. You're still a European. The European peoples, if you really need for the European people to justify their existence, for them to have evolved separately hundreds of thousands of years ago, then you might come up, we might have some problems, because I don't think that really happened. But it did, we have been distinguished for, quite a long time, maybe close to 100,000 years.
Really, what's so disgusting about all of this is that Pakistan has only existed as a country for 70 years, and yet the Pakistanis are recognized as a nation and an ethnic group in their own right. And, you know, there are certain words that I'm not going to say on air that are deemed racist against them. And yet we have existed for thousands of years, and yet we somehow don't exist as a specific ethnic group.
Yeah, exactly. It's the point is, like, the people who are saying, you know, because we all come from Africa, therefore you have no right to be British, they're not saying that to other people who they also believe come from Africa. They're not saying that to everyone, are they? So don't get bogged down on trying to disprove something that looks pretty much proven. I mean, there's quite a lot of mounting evidence on it. The multi-regional hypothesis, which I believe in, which people think is an alternative to the out-of-Africa hypothesis, that still says that we have a common ancestor in Africa. So the multi-regional hypothesis is that there were also other hominids around the world that hybridized with the population that migrated out of Africa. And that's what did happen. But there is still at least some common ancestry for all living human beings in Africa. But there's also, the thing is, like, there's also been a lot of change within Africa since those people left, and a lot of change outside Africa since those people left. And there's lots of change and constant change. Like, Ashkenazi Jews are distinguished from, you know, other Jews, and they're distinguished as a population with less than 1,000 years, maybe just 800 years of a bottleneck, and then some close breeding, shall we say. And that's enough to have given them some very advantageous genetic traits and some very disadvantaged genetic traits as well. So you can, even in just 800 years of genetic isolation, can make a massive difference and can make a genetically distinct population. So you don't have to be concentrating on what happened 100,000 years ago. Because I personally think, and a lot of people think this, what makes Northern and Northwestern European, like, or Europe in general, distinct, it's not stuff that happened in the Ice Age. It's stuff that's happened in the Bronze Age and since, like, genetically to us. We've become better in the Bronze Age and since. We've been improving. So I don't think it really we don't even need to talk about, we should talk about, because it's interesting science to go back right back far in. But I don't think that's the source of our uniqueness or of that important to our sense of self. I mean, from Ruins to Ruins, I focused on the Anglo-Saxon era in the medieval time, because that's when our nation became founded. And I mean, if I wanted to talk about from a genetic perspective, I think that the Northwestern European genetic group, as it's currently known, came into existence around 4,500 years ago. So that's when what you should talk about if you want to talk about Northwest Europe. But
and that's enough. I mean, that's enough of a history. You know,
that's a lot.
4,000 years. It's a bloody long time. So if that's not enough to give you a sense of, well, dignity, identity, and mystery, well, you know, you're a bit bloody hard to please.
Yeah, I'd say so too. That should be enough. And it's never been, no human population has ever had to justify themselves in that way before. They never had to say, like, oh, can you trace your ancestry back to the Stone Age in order to justify your continued existence as a distinct population? It's an absurd premise. And actually, by arguing against it, you're kind of accepting it as a premise. It's not fair. It doesn't matter. Even if we only, like, popped out of the soil 100 years ago, it's still here. It's ours first. So I wouldn't argue against that premise.
Yeah, absolutely. Another random question that came into the chat is, what's your Myers-Briggs personality type?
INTJ.
Right. Right. Okay. I think somebody was opining that you might be an INTP. So he'll perhaps be a wee bit disappointed now.
What does the P stand for?
Perceiving as opposed to judging.
Well, it's been a long time. Maybe I've changed. I don't know.
Well, you know, I changed in the course of doing the channel. I started off as an INTP, and then 2 years later, I did the test again, and I was INFJ. And I don't know. It honestly wouldn't surprise me if my habits of mind had changed in that time, because the channel was a big, intellectual exercise for me.
But it's not supposed to be fixed. It's not meant to be like you're born with a personality type. It changes with your experiences, anyway.
Yeah, and that makes sense. It makes sense that it would, because obviously your brain, your ways of thinking do change. And anyway, that was just a different random wee question. Another one is: can you do a Finnish accent?
Oh, it's hard to do, but they kind of talk like a robot. They don't have any pitches. It's just what I'm not that like anyone who actually knows Finns will be saying how awful that was. But they kind of talk like this. They're very good. Something like that.
Thank you, Survive the Jive, for doing a Finnish. I might ask you to say goodbye at the end in that accent. And next year I'll ask you.
Sorry,
to do the
Finns.
Entire
sorry, I didn't mean to offend any Finnish people, but they're all INTJ, so they're all like my people, really.
All right. Now, was there another one about the? Let's have a look at the super chats. Right, someone says it's a very Indo-European stream. Yes, and here's a rather controversial one. Should paganism replace Christianity for us whites?
The problem with the idea of the word should, it's like, I don't take this view of history and of like the masses and people and like whites I don't look at things in terms of the masses, like whether it's the best religion for the masses or not, or whether it's politically advantageous. This is what I believe in. There's no other reason for me being a pagan. That's what I believe in. I don't look at, if it was, could be shown to me to demonstrate it absolutely that paganism is a dead end for European people and it's much more politically advantageous for them to have a different religion, I still wouldn't change my religion, because that's not why I chose it. I chose it because this is what I believe in. And that's the only reason why anyone should ever choose a religion. It's not about your political perspective. I don't know if people want what's better, but I think that it's Christianity has been in decline, and that the forms of Christianity currently practiced in Western Europe now are quite different from what the actual tenets of the religion require them to be, how it's meant to be practiced. So I don't know what will happen with the future of that. And, I don't like to, like a lot of pagans do, constantly attacking Christians. I don't see it as, it's not a religious activity for me. It doesn't I don't think it's like, will bring me a boon from the gods if I'm like always attacking people for their faith. I don't think it helps me in my personal life. I don't think it helps other people. I don't see anything positive from it at all. And I think a lot of the time that people do that, they really have unresolved issues, and that's why they're doing it. And and I would advise people just to be a little bit less, hung up on what other people's religions are. Just practice, focus on actually practicing the religion that you claim to practice as properly, which is a big thing to do. It's difficult to be, a virtuous person according to the tenets of any traditional path. So just try and focus on that a bit before you focus on converting the world to your way of thinking.
Yeah. I would agree with that for sure, that advice. Okay, that I think that's all the super chats, or was there another one? Let me see. Hold on. I see. I'm trying to be more diligent about the super chat. Oh, here we go. What's your opinion on Rome's effect on Europeans?
Rome, the Roman Empire, and everything, including going right up into Christian Rome and the Vatican and everything as well, because that's quite a big thing. I'd say, well, it's obviously.
And the modern HBO series as well.
I did watch that and I enjoyed it, actually, because I didn't enjoy Vikings because I could see it was completely rubbish. But because I'm not as well versed on the specifics of Roman archaeology and history, I probably didn't notice as many of the glaring errors in Rome. But I enjoyed that. I'd say that Rome was instrumental in the formation of Europe as a concept. It didn't exist before them. And they helped to define it. Of course, what they called Europe, we wouldn't call Europe. I mean, they were looking south. So to them, you know, much of what we consider to be non-Europe, much of Asia Minor and even the north side of the Med were their neighbors. I mean, the south side of the Med were their neighbors. So whereas we consider that not Europe, and the barbarians of the north were not of their, you know, group. Whereas that's what we now consider also to be exemplary of a European phenotype, the people from there. So, yeah, it's not the same thing, but it certainly planted the roots for a concept of Europeanness. And, I think there's a lot to be said for, like, the sheer power and ingenuity of Rome as a civilization. There's some bad things as well, I guess. But, the problem is, you can't, it's a hypothetical, like, I don't know what would have happened if Rome didn't exist. So whether another civilization would have filled that void or whether civilization, as some people, a lot of the, Uncle Ted gang will say that civilization was a mistake in the first place. So maybe we should all just run around naked in the woods and bash each other with rocks or whatever.
Well, it might come to that. right, so I think that's all the super. Are there any other questions for Survive the Giant? Because this is your chance. I should have said that. In the meantime, somebody, Boiled Sweets, has been very insistent that we should both watch a film called The Field. And I believe John Hurt was in this. I think it was like the late 80s or something, because I seem to recall seeing maybe it was in the video shop when I was small. The Field. Have you heard of this? It's an Irish film.
I've heard of A Field in England. I don't think I've heard of The Field. I'm just looking now. 1990?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay. Wait, is this about... okay, I've seen a clip from it that was posted to antagonize Anglos. And it had a guy in a pub kicking off saying about how... Well, he was doing quite a stirring nationalistic speech about... This is my land. It's always been my land. Blah, blah, blah. And the English did this and we got rid of them. So, yeah, I can see that. But, I never thought of watching it because I just thought it was some anti-English film. But maybe I should give it a chance.
Well, Boiled Sweets seems very convinced that we would both like it. Hold on a second. Let me see where I've missed her. I can't see it now. Sorry. Anyway, she was saying it quite a few times. So the other one is, what do you think about The Company of Wolves? I've seen this. I saw this when I was 17 or 18, and I seem to remember liking it. It's got some fun 80s special effects. It's a werewolf film, and it's quite fun. But it's Neil Jordan, if I recall correctly. And there's some... I think the actress was only ever in that and never in anything else. I'm not sure. And that's Stephen Rea. Yes, that's right, because he was then in several of Neil Jordan's subsequent films, including Interview with the Vampire, actually.
I'm going to watch all these suggestions. I do listen to suggestions, and I will watch them.
Well, if you've got any other questions or film recommendations for Survive the Jive, please let us know, and I'll try to convey them to him. But, of course, it's difficult. Yeah, you've got to remember to tag my name, because otherwise bloody difficult. So, okay. All right. Mm. Okay. Please ask to what extent practicing European paganism requires being European?
Well, I'd say that the thing is, although there would never have been any codified rules about, ethnic requirements for the religion, it wouldn't in that sense be comparable exactly to Judaism, where they say, you're meant to be born into the religion. But it would be comparable to Shinto in Japan, the way that is now. So there's no rule that says non-Japanese can't practice Shinto. But from the Japanese perspective, why would you want to? Like, the whole being Shinto is part of Japanese culture. It's integrated into it. The German religion, like the Germanic religion, wasn't, they didn't know it was a religion, because the term religion is really like a post-Abrahamic influence idea. What they were doing was being Germans, or being Nordic people, or being Gauls. Their religious practices were integrated with their way of life. It was part of their being and their culture. So the problem is when these are being revived now in a post-Christian society, we think of paganism as a religion, which means it's something you do, which you learn about and pick up and choose to do, rather than something that is part, an innate part, integrated into your culture. So, of course, when we're doing that, we're also thinking, like, I want to do this because that was integrated into the culture of my ancestors. Now, why someone would choose to willingly adopt the spiritual aspect of a culture, of a people who they have no relation to, I don't know. I don't understand why someone would do that. I mean, there's no rules or any forces preventing them from doing so if they really wanted to.
Right. Okay, I was just trying to keep up with the super the chat there. Someone's written carnivore diet and Neanderthal ancestry? I don't know what that means.
Carnivore. So he's saying that the presence of Neanderthal DNA facilitates a higher, or like necessitates perhaps a higher protein diet than its absence does, and I don't think that's true, because here's. I mean, it may be that Neanderthals had higher protein diets than modern humans do, and that they were evolved to eat more meat than we do. I don't know. But the thing is, we don't know which bits of Neanderthal DNA we got. So, like, different people have different amounts of Neanderthal DNA and different parts of the DNA from Neanderthals for different reasons. So since the people in Africa, hunter-gatherers in Africa who left there, and all hominid species, in fact, were evolved to eat as much protein as they were capable of getting, it doesn't make any difference having it. And also, we can look at there are some interesting, I've seen some interesting studies, I can't remember off the top of my head, about ethnic variation and dietary requirements. So, like, some diets can work better for some people depending on ethnicity, but actually West Africans who have zero Neanderthal DNA also do well with high protein diets. I think the people in the world who do quite well with very little, or comparatively little, is Indians, South Asians. But I don't think this has anything to do, once again, I don't think you need to go so far back to Neanderthals to explain this. It's just a case of how recently have they been introduced to farming, or like or farming of staple crops. So, yeah, people in Italy have had a lot more access, like historically been a few thousand years extra on people in Scandinavia on eating wheat. So perhaps, you know, they're going to be able to eat a lot more pasta with a lot less bolognese or something, whereas in Sweden they would need a little bit more meat. But that is not, you know, fully looked into. This is an area that needs to be looked into and will be looked into a lot, because now that DNA testing is becoming cheaper, in the future we'll be able to get your medicine won't be prescribed just on what your illnesses, but actually you'll get, like, they'll do a DNA test and choose which medicine works best for your specific genetics, and also probably diets as well, because within races there is, you know, there's variation as well. So some guy who is white might be fine vegetarian, and another guy who's white might not be very healthy if he was a vegetarian. So that kind of thing, I think, will be in the future one of the popular applications of genetics.
All right, I've got quite a few questions here. Oh, here's another super chat. 4% Neanderthal, bidding you both happy winter solstice. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Neanderthal guy.
Okay. All right, so some of these other questions. Can you explain the origins of the Black Irish?
Yeah, it's just a phenotypical variation. Once again, people want to go too far back to explain something that's quite easy. You don't have to do that. Like, if I have... Let's say I have three children. One's ginger, one's blonde, and one's black-haired. And only one of them marries and has children, the one with black hair. and he repopulates the whole village because he's a real ladies' man. Well, you can be sure that it won't take very long before black hair becomes more, in a few generations, more common feature of people from that village. It's very simple. It doesn't take very long. You don't need to have an invasion of foreign people. Like, there's already the presence of black hair has always been in Europe. It's been, that's an older phenotype. Blonde and red hair come later. So there's never, ever been a society in Europe with just blonde hair and or just red hair. When blonde hair and red hair comes into Europe, it's like different populations had variation like we do today. Some people have brown hair, some people have red hair, some people have blonde hair. And that's why Irish people, some people have darker features and some people have lighter features. The reason that you can get like very closely related peoples, like one part of Ireland and another part of Ireland, have such different phenotypes isn't from different racial origins. It's just because in that area, some guy or girl, more likely a guy, was very genetically successful at filling his biological imperative. And he happened to have that phenotype.
Okay. Now, how many Holy Isles do we have in Britain? And does Glastonbury count as one?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Holy Isles are an interesting topic, but I don't know the number. I don't know that. So I can't answer it. But I think that the idea of the Holy Isle is more about not actual real islands. And although there's some lovely things like the one on Holy Island of Lindisfarne and Mont Saint-Michel in Cornwall, or, you know, all these little pretty islands off the coast of the British Isles. But the point is that in Celtic mythology, this disappearing island was like a seat of the divine. And it doesn't refer to a real place necessarily. It's a metaphysical concept, a mythological concept about an unattainable divine seat, something to aspire towards. And if you want really good writing on it, go to the master himself, Julius Evola, who's written about this in his book on the Holy Grail. It's The Mystery of the Grail. Read that.
Okay. Now we'll just work our way through these questions. And wait there. Thoughts on The Name of the Rose, another film? I think it was a book originally. Was that a,
yes,
a book?
Umberto,
yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
I like that film because of the cozy atmosphere of medieval society. And that is another thing, like we just talked about folk horror. It's the opposite of what was intended. The idea, it's written from a liberal, modern perspective, progressive perspective. The idea that this detective, like who's a monk, but like he's like a medieval detective, crime solving. He's like, his way of thinking is like a precursor, like a modern man in the medieval times. And the medieval times are dark and stupid and superstitious. And like, and the light of progress is trying to shine through into the future. And that's not true. That's not at all an accurate representation of medieval Europe. It's totally wrong. And it's stupid, in fact. But the film works because it's not read like that. Like, people see it as like a quite nice, beautiful castles, lovely, interesting murder mystery film set in like a beautiful medieval setting. And that's how I see it.
All right. I mean, I think that part of the appeal for people though is that there is a sense that these, back then there was a sense of mystery and, you know, magic and superstition. It's like, it's comfy and cozy, but part of the reason it is that people were not as rational as they are today. That's the perception. Yeah. I'm not saying it's true.
Yeah. Is the opposite of what the author intended. Mm. He didn't want people to see it as like a nice thing to go there. He wanted to see it as like the struggle of whatever Sean Connery's character is called, like to make rationality and logic, you know, prosper in an age of superstition. So yeah, and the fact that it failed is evidence that there is an innate need in human beings for something else.
Yes. Okay. Someone's asking about your appearance on Swedish mainstream media after a church robbery.
Yes. Oh yeah. What do they want to know about that?
just the story briefly.
Okay. Well, I was planning my wedding in a town called Strangness, and it was a weekend. It was a week before my wedding on that weekend in the Cathedral of Strangness, which is an interesting place because it was founded because of an Englishman. An English pilgrim went there because Strangness was a holy site for the Nordic pagans. And he went to them and said, stop doing that in the middle of a blot, and told them to stop doing the sacrifice. So they all threw rocks at him and killed him and carried on with their sacrifice. And then later on, after the Swedes converted to Christianity, they decided to build a church there on the top of this holy pagan site. And it's that site that I was, which is a great cathedral, beautiful cathedral. That was where I was married. But when I was just having a plowance for my lunch, and I was with some...
Just before you continue, I was once walking down a street in Edinburgh, and I passed a pub, and I looked at the menu, and it said Plowperson's Lunch.
No, seriously.
I couldn't believe it. It was about 5 years. I know. It was about 5 or 6 years ago when I thought, fucking hell. Yeah, it's true. It was just so ugly. But anyway, go on.
Gosh. No, you've shaken me. You've shaken me.
I didn't mean to. I thought it would be an amusing anecdote. But yeah, it's pretty troubling, isn't it?
Yeah, so I was enjoying my plowperson's lunch, and then one of the people I was with noticed peculiar behaviour, or two of the people I was with noticed it, of some men on the pier down beneath on the lawn. We were sitting on a lawn, and at the end of the lawn was a pier going onto the lake, and I was rather distracted by the by my lunch and by the arrangements for the wedding, which was a stressful time. So I didn't pay full attention to what the men looked like anything, but soon I did notice that it was very odd, and they were speeding away in a boat. And then suddenly police cars were everywhere. And I said, this is what's happened. We just witnessed a robbery. And then I gave a statement, and the two people I was with, I told them to give statements because I didn't see the men who did the robbery. They did. And, then the media were there, a national paper, and they did an interview with me as I went for a swim later in that day. And as I was walking back from the lake from my swim, the media interviewed me. And then they sold that on to The Guardian, The Telegraph, The New York Times, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, everywhere around the world. And I suddenly was on international news accidentally. But yeah, that's the story. And they haven't got it back yet. Sorry, the thing they stole, I didn't say this, the cathedral had the crown jewels in it, not the crown jewels, like our crown jewels in England, because they have many crown jewels from different kings over time, but some crown jewels from a king or a queen in like 1600s or something like that, like their equivalent of the Tudors.
God, it's so disgusting.
And yeah, the guys involved were like, oh, you can guess. I mean, I didn't see them, so I can't say what ethnicity they were. But I know that the police have been researching in, the usual suspects, put it that way. And the people I was with who did see them, they just said that they looked dark.
Moving on. Oh, I did see something amusing in the live chat just now. Someone said, plough NPCs lunch. Pretty good. So now the next one was views on demographic projections. Will we survive the transformation? It's a bit of bloody grim and
pass.
Pass. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Sorry, but it's just a bit. That's a sort of epic and very serious question.
It's a bit too big a question.
Yeah, I don't think either of us is in the mood for it just now. What do you know about Celtic paganism? Why does Germanic paganism always take the spotlight?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I don't know as much about Celtic paganism, but I got several books on it, and I read some of them, but I haven't read all of them. But the thing about there's a couple of reasons why. I mean, for other people in general, I think the reason Germanic paganism takes the spotlight is the type of sources. So there are lots of different kinds of sources from Celtic paganism. Most of them Irish. But all of them are a lot further away from the time of conversion than the time that the Germanic sources were written after their conversion, a lot further. And they are really a bit harder to read into the form of a religion. So there's such rich folklore from Ireland and Scotland and Wales and things. And that folklore is very much integrated into the Christianity that followed. So it wasn't completely done away with. It's not like the differences with Snorri is Snorri Sturluson wasn't writing down about the surviving pagan folklore in the Christian times. He was writing about how paganism had been practiced before the conversion. And he specifies that. So that makes it much easier to just read it and pick it up and understand what the paganism was like. But when you're talking about Celtic paganism, it means you have to really try to, you know, understand things. And then that means the historians have come up with very different interpretations and then arguments about that. So that's one reason. It's not as accessible is one reason. Then personally, for me, I think that I say, and people say, "What aren't you, you know, Celtic, or whatever, in Britain?" And I say that I don't think we are Celtic English people. Yes, we have ancestors who spoke Celtic languages, but the British people, when the Celtic invasion came into the British Isles and Scotland, Ireland, England, Wales, they were already, before that invasion, pretty much genetically the same. So the people who brought the Celtic languages in from continental Europe, somewhere around Germany or Czech Republic, they didn't change the genetics very much. So does that mean we say that they were only, the British people were then 5% Celtic? Or something. We don't say that, do we? We just say they were Celtic because they adopted Celtic languages and Celtic religion. So then when the Anglo-Saxons come in, it was a much bigger shift, making maybe 40 or 50% the difference in England. And we adopted an Anglo-Saxon religion and an Anglo-Saxon language. But then people say, oh, we're 50% Anglo-Saxon. But that doesn't make sense. Because if you use that logic, then you have to say we're only 5% or 4% Celtic or something. But you don't say that. They say 50% Celtic, 50% Anglo-Saxon or something. So there's no consistency in the way you're calculating percentages. And if you're trying to calculate a percentage of a culture, that doesn't make any sense. You're trying to do it for DNA. You want to say how much continental Celtic DNA and how much continental Germanic DNA. Fine. But then we still have more Germanic. Most of our DNA comes from the initial migration of Belbeke people 4,500 years ago into the British Isles, but we don't know what religion they had, but it's almost certainly an Indo-European religion, just like Celtic and Germanic religions. But you know what? The material culture of the Belbeke people was more like that of the Anglo-Saxons than the Celts, because the Celts stopped doing barrows almost entirely, except in parts of Yorkshire. But the Anglo-Saxons then restored the barrow culture that had existed in the Bronze Age in Britain. So, I mean, that's not the reason why I consider myself Germanic. I'm just saying, you know, like it wasn't like a foreign thing in that sense. It was just another Indo-European culture for Indo-European people to follow. And my reasoning for being Germanic is because I speak a Germanic language. I was raised in a Germanic country. Our parliament is founded on a Germanic system of law. And the Germanic sources on Germanic paganism are much easier to understand, so that's why I got more into them. But I like Celtic paganism. I think it's very interesting. I'd like to learn more about it.
Right, there's a slew of new questions. I mean, I have to say, it's obvious that there's a real appetite for asking you questions, so I think that you should maybe do an AMA on your own channel.
I will. I've never done one. I'll probably do one, yeah, see if I get some super chats off it.
Yeah, you would. I mean, I can talk you through how to set it all up if you want, because people have got loads of questions for you. Try to answer these like very briefly. What do you know about the Picts?
I don't know very much about them. I like their art.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know what language they spoke. We don't know. So.
Okay. Who built the stone circles?
Neolithic European farmers.
Okay. How many kids should we have?
Three.
Right. Okay. Leave those ones. And there are some over here. Have you watched Hrafninn Fligur? I think...
Hrafninn Fligur, is that an Icelandic spaghetti western style saga film, I think? If it is, then yes, I have. Yeah, right. It's good fun. It's like a Viking saga, like in Iceland, but it's portrayed in a kind of, like, it's filmed like a spaghetti western. It's cool, and I like it. Yeah, it's sort of folk horror, I guess, in a way as well.
Okay. How could Vikings, the TV show, have been more realistic?
They shouldn't have dressed like gay bikers. They shouldn't have had hipster haircuts. They shouldn't have had threesomes with Christian slaves. They shouldn't have had this, like, an Arab holding a slave market in Scandinavia. They shouldn't have
had the hello, hello style accents, like trying to represent being foreign. There's a million things. They should have known. They should have had Uppsala shouldn't have been in the mountains. They should have known where England was, since they'd been like trading with it the centuries or more. Like, they wouldn't be surprised that a place called England existed, like it was like Columbus going to America or something. It's just completely riddled with nonsense. I don't know where to start. The whole thing is just a complete, and all the Shield Maidens thing is completely blown out of proportion as well.
They did a press five if you want Survive the Jive to do an AME, and loads of people have pressed five. So I think that's
okay, I will do one. Yeah. I'll do one next year, definitely.
Okay. All right. Now, what else? What do you know about the Swedish town Finspång?
Finspång. I recognise the name, but I don't know where it's from. Is it Finspång or something?
It may be. The A's got a strange thing on top of it.
Yeah, in Östergötland. I've been to Östergötland. I don't think I've been to Finspång. I don't know what. No, sorry, can't say.
Okay. Could the Catholic Church do anything to make up for the Northern Crusades?
Oh, what is this, like reparations or something? Like, I don't like historical grievance. You know, like demands for reparations and stuff. I don't believe in that. Of course not. I'm British. What would be the implication?
All right.
Get a bill in the post.
Okay. And what was the other one? What is? And here's a good question. First of all, what do you think of the ancient Orcadians? I think that might have been a new age band in the 70s.
Interesting. No, this is interesting. I went to Orkney, and like Orkney has been a baffling thing for many people because there was they call it the Egypt of the North. There was a great big civilization up there like 5,000 years ago. Why they wanted to live up there, who knows? It's a very desolate, windy, cold place. They wanted to be there for some reason, the Neolithic Europeans. So the people who lived there would have been genetically quite similar to Spanish people or other Southern Europeans. And for some reason, though, like I probably shouldn't say this, but there are medieval texts where some medieval Christians got in their head that the original inhabitants of the Orkneys were African Jews.
All right, let's just change the subject, for heaven's sake.
But there's I don't know why they thought that.
Now, go on, and if you want to finish that point,
I don't know why they thought that, but I think it was to do with, I read one theory that was just based on the idea that they were wrong because they weren't Christian, whoever they were, and in medieval times, like being religiously wrong was associated with Jews, so they just projected Jewishness onto it. And I don't know why they said African. Of course, there's never been any African DNA found anywhere on the British Isles. Any sub-Saharan African DNA has ever been found, but that's not to say that they even refer to sub-Saharan Africans anyway, because I don't know what they mean, African Jews. I don't know what that meant to a medieval person. I don't know what they were talking about, but
just new Europeans, future Europeans.
He was seeing into the future. Yeah, African Jews will own Orkney. No, it was built long before Judaism existed. It was built in, as I say, like 5,000 years ago. It's contemporary with Egypt. It may be just that they knew in medieval times that it was so old, and they associated it with Jewish people with being very old, because that, like, they only just got literacy from Christianity. So as far as they're concerned, the older civilizations were the ones in the Bible. So that's why they assume. They just say, this is really old, so it must have been Jews. Something like that.
Right, okay. All right. And what is the best film to watch about medieval Europe, in your opinion?
Oh, the best film to watch?
I think it means like a fiction film.
Yeah, I guess so. Let me think. I love the Ingmar Bergman film, it's called The Virgin Spring in English, but that is the Swedish name is Jungfrau Kellen. I think it's pronounced like that, and that means same thing, the Virgin Spring, and it's based on a medieval story, and it's set in medieval Sweden about a lovely young Christian virgin who gets murdered. And then a spring comes up, and that becomes a sacred spring. But it also has a lot of pagan themes in it. And it's not a pro-pagan film,
it's kind of, the original story is obviously a Christian story about why paganism is bad. The people who kill her in the film aren't pagans. The pagans are involved in the story in other ways, but Ingmar Bergman's not doing it like a Christian morality tale. He's just doing it as doing his like German style, I think it's called German expressionism, that kind of film. It's black and white. It's just a really beautiful piece of cinema. And also, if you like that, his other one in medieval times is his most famous film, The Seventh Seal, which is also great. Now, I don't know if they're accurate, particularly accurate pieces of medieval cinema, but they're good pieces of cinema. And that's really why I think you should watch them.
All right. Okay, what do you think of new religions, e.g. No. That was a dance track in the late 90s.
Oh, well, it was based on the religion, Santeria. Yeah, it's a religion.
Sorry, I didn't think of that possibility. Yeah. No, it's Santo Dame or Dime or something like that. D-A-I-M-E.
Santa Dime. I don't know what that is. Sorry. I can't answer. I wish I could help you there. I've never heard of it. Santo Dime. Thoughts on it. Is it written in here? Grafenflüger, Finspong, Orcadians. No, I don't. Oh, Santo Dime. No, I don't know what that is. I guess it's something from Spain or somewhere, but I don't know about. It might be Latin American. Like Santeria, like voodoo or something like that, but they're usually, if it's one of those kind of things, it's usually like a mixture of Catholicism, some kind of folk religion. Like, I think they often have like some intuitive natural expressions of human faith. Like there are certain behaviors that all human beings defer to when they have like religious experiences. Like they make idols of gods, or they parade them, and they worship them, they try and like plead with them to help make things better for them. And those are things that are generally called pagan. So when like scriptural religions sort of get isolated and mixed with other folk traditions among illiterate people, then they often abandon the scriptural laws and revert to a more natural form of religion.
Okay. Now there was one other question I wanted to, I'll delay that for a wee bit. What was the one about Christmas? There was a nice one about Christmas. I thought that'd be a good one to end with. And where the fuck is it now? I've made this list, but I can't see it now. That's a damn shame. Anyway, okay, we'll just have to go without that one. And I'll ask you that: would straw dogs be folk horror?
I think yeah. I think yes, it would. For those who aren't aware, that's a film about a Jewish guy from America who moves to Cornwall with his wife, who's Cornish, and then she's raped by the Cornish people, and then the Jewish guy has to defend the village retard from a mob of Cornish people who want to kill the retard for raping someone else or something. So it's actually it's not just about like the intelligent, sophisticated New York Jewish guy and the savage Cornish people. Although that is an aspect, there is a more interesting part of it, which I think Sam Peckinpah was trying to communicate. And it's definitely a folk horror film, but that is that the civilized Jewish guy becomes the barbarian at the end, smacking people with things. So it's saying that like the veneer of civilization is very thin, and we're all savages.
Like Lord of the Flies kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same as Lord of the Flies, but with Cornish rape.
Right, okay. Do you have any beer recommendations?
I like bitter, so I don't know. It depends what you drink. I like, I don't like IPA, it's too hoppy. I don't like lager, it's too fizzy. I like just normal, malty English country beer. I like Exmoor Ale. There's the Exmoor Brewery's ale. I like, when I lived in Berkshire growing up, I liked a beer called Good Old Boy from West Berkshire Breweries. And when I lived in Brighton, I used to drink Harvey's Best Bitter from Harvey's, which is a very, very old brewery in the village of Lewes. And when in that village, when they a local pub tried to serve another beer that wasn't brewed in the village, the villagers rioted. They said, you know, you'll serve Lewis beer in Lewis. And I wish that kind of spirit, people would get that angry in Britain about other things besides beer. But it's a good sign.
Mm. And then cheekily, people have posted yet more questions, but I think I'm going to have to just ignore them because, you know...
You've got another one coming up, right?
Yeah, Duke of Durham is supposed to be starting right now, so I don't know what to
sorry,
do.
Oh, sorry, Duke. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Yeah. I've just messaged him on Telegram. Hopefully he'll contact me, and I'll because I don't know if he's even ready yet, because he might not be ready. I know that he was having to really sort of make some special arrangements to in order to do this, so hopefully he'll... message me back.
Well, I won't disrupt your schedule any further.
No, 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 it's fine. Until he's ready, there's no point in us going off air anyway. So there was, well, unless you want to go, I don't know. But was there not, there was another question that related to, oh, well, hold on a second. I'll just take one from the, how Indo-European is Christmas?
Very. But leave it at that.
All right.
I've said a lot about a lot of podcasts. If anyone wants to hear me talk about Christmas, I've spoken for hours about it on different things, including on the first millennial I did in 2015 and other THA podcasts and on Red Ice. So I've said so much about Christmas. And it's not necessary for me to go over the same stuff over again and again.
Okay. And there's one last super chat here. Subscribed since 4K and took part in prototype Yule Live Hangout once in 2015. So amazing to see the growth and increase of quality. Jive is somewhat of a cultured thug, by the way. Merry Yule to all. Delenda S. Babylonis. I've probably not pronounced that correctly. I apologize.
Thank you for the nice comment.
Okay. So I guess that's it. Any last things to say about the folk horror genre and the book?
Well, I just think check out folk horror, and maybe it's not for everyone, but it's just I think it's good that we look at, you know, think about what if we had control of entertainment and media, what would we put on for people to be entertained by? What kinds of art would be on television? And that's something that if you're thinking of being a creator, and I think like a lot of people probably here listening have some kind of creative skills that they're not using and they're not putting the effort they could into, start making things and trying to do, looking at gaps, because the mainstream, the mass media isn't providing the kinds of things that everybody wants. And those gaps are what you should be looking at doing and creating as a creative person to try and, you know, fill those gaps. And then provide, you know, be part of the counterculture.
Right. Indeed. I mean, I can only repeat what Jive just said, because, you know, obviously I want more and more of our kind of stuff on YouTube and elsewhere. One last thing here. Somebody's clarified, Finspong is the town where the nation betrayer will get their punishment. So there we are. I don't.
Is that to do with the guy you spoke to the other day? Is that where?
I don't know.
You spoke to the Swedish guy.
Oh, no, I think it's separate from that. Separate from that. And someone says, I'll make a graphic novel with you, Jive. So, okay, you can contact him in your own time. All right, so let's leave it at that, because this I wanted it to be just about folk horror, but it's become a huge AMA. So I really think that you should do AMAs. I think
it's fun to answer those questions, so I guess I should do that. I never really thought of doing it before, but now I can see that there's definitely a demand for it, so I'll do one.
Yeah, do it. All right, so, well, any last things to say, or should we just end
only it? Thank you very much, Rose, for inviting me on again. It's always a pleasure to be on here and have a chat with you. I've enjoyed this very much. And a very good Yule to you and yours.
Well, thank you very much, and you too. And excellent. Well, this was Survive the Jive on Millennial 2018. Thank you for taking part. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I know that I think you were one of the most requested guests, if not the most requested guest. I'm not sure. So. Yeah. So thank you for coming on. And I will be back very shortly with Duke of Durham, who has confirmed that he's ready to go on air. So I'll be back very soon with him. In the meantime, go and grab a bitter beer in honour of Survive the Jive. Yeah. And I'll see you all soon. Okay. Thank you, and bye for now.